Welcome, everyone, to this session of Sunstone, which was session 356, if that means anything to anybody. We're shutting out some noise. I'm kind of an indefatigable proselytizer for certain things. And one of those is the Liahona Children's Foundation. Ta-da! Wearing the T-shirt, and my wife Gloria was wearing one yesterday. And I've got some packages of things here. These are going to become... The Liahona Children's Foundation is the only foundation in the world dedicated completely to addressing malnutrition among Latter-day Saint children. We've been doing this for about 12 years. Started out with one little project in Ecuador, and now we're in 200 congregations in 20 countries around the world, from Mongolia to Mozambique. It's great fun, and we've got a booth down over at this part of the project, and I just encourage anyone we can. And these T-shirts, you can buy one of these beautiful T-shirts, which is going to become a collector's item because we're changing our name. We don't know yet what it's going to be changed to, but it's going to be changed from this. So you can buy this beautiful T-shirt for $10, which is less than it costs to produce. So anyway, enough with my commercials, but anyway, it's a commercial close to my heart. When Peggy Stack and Scott Kenny came to me when I was editor of Dialogue many years ago. They said, they came to see me at UCLA and said, we're thinking of starting a new magazine. And I said, great, what a good idea. And I probably have some manuscripts that you could use if you wanted to do that. And I said, what are you going to call it? And they said, Whetstone. And I said, I've got a better idea. Why don't you call it Sunstone? And they said, why? And I said, because the sun and the stone are two of the archetypal symbols of our culture, and because it's identified with Mormonism and the temple, and because the sun shines its light, and the stone is the foundation. I said, there are all kinds of imagining possibilities. And so they said, that's a good idea. And so these many years later, what is it, 40-some-odd, that Sunstone has been going? I've lost track. The idea, I think, of those things behind that are things that seem to me represent the best of Sunstone. Foundation and light, the radiance of the sun and the solidity of the stone, the rock on which our faith is founded. So at Graduate Theological Union, where I teach Mormonism, we have had the Eugene England Memorial Lecture for several years. And in the fall, last fall, Richard Bushman came and gave a presentation called Radiant Mormonism. And it was a wonderful talk. Some of you may have read about it in the Salt Lake Tribune. Anyways, I thought about that. I thought, this would be a good session to do at Sunstone. We ought to do an annual session called Radiant Mormonism, in which we invited people who exemplify that radiance to come and just talk about their lives and how that radiance is exemplified in their devotion and in their engagement with Mormonism. So this is the first of those, and I'm going to put this down and move over to that chair where my good friend and Radiant Mormon Jay Griffith and I will spend a period of time talking, and then we'll have these two beautiful, radiant women sitting here on the front row, Erica Munson and her mother, Greta Peterson, come up and continue the radiance. Now I'm in a different place. One of the things we're doing at GTU, starting next fall, we're initiating an annual Radiant Mormonism lecture. We will be honoring someone who exemplifies Radiant Mormonism to come and give a lecture or a presentation or be part of a discussion. And I hope that will be part of the ongoing program in Mormon Studies at Graduate Theological Union. And since we are hoping to establish a chair in the honor of Eugene England, Gene was certainly one of the most radiant Latter-day Saints of my generation, if I can call whatever I've been involved in a generation. I'm very pleased that we'll be able to do that. In his essay on Radiant Mormonism, Richard argued that Latter-day Saints have a disproportionate influence for good in the world. He cites examples in scholarship, education, philanthropy, politics, humanitarian service, and the arts, but feels the influence is much broader than that. He says, the term radiant suggests that certain Latter-day Saints radiate from Mormonism like rays of light and beams of energy from the sun. They are not official, but a part of each of them originates in the church and in core Mormonism. They are part of a great Mormon sphere of influence that reaches far beyond the church itself. In their book, The Triple Package, Amy Chua and Jed Rubenfeld identify Latter-day Saints as among the six most successful ethnic and religious groups in the United States. Of those six groups, only two are religious, Mormons and Jews. The others are all hyphenated, Cuban Americans, Nigerian Americans, Chinese Americans, and Indian Americans. The authors assert there's only one group of Americans in the United States today who are hitting it out of the park with conventional success. It's the Mormons. Unfortunately, they have a rather narrow idea of success, one that Oliver Wendell Holmes spoke of as vulgar success, success which is measured by political, financial, and cultural influence. They confess, quote, goodness, religiosity, and impulsive self-awareness are not what modern economies reward. True. The kind of success they identify stems from what they call the triple package. And they say Mormons are one of the groups that exemplify these three characteristics. A superiority complex. We're number one, and we're true, and we're good. A sense of insecurity. We're not quite as good as we, or people may not know we're quite as good as we think we are, and maybe we're not so sure. And impulse control, discipline, self-reliance. Those three things, they say, are what makes for success, and these don't seem to have an awful lot to do with the radiance Bushman identifies. He says, Radiant Mormonism is not core Mormonism. It's not under ecclesiastical priesthood direction. Its aim is not typically conversion or salvation, the work of the church. But Radiant Mormonism is elevating. It improves the world. It operates on the principle of goodwill. Underlying it is the desire to work for the good of humankind. This session begins what I hope will be an annual celebration of the radiance that is at the heart of Mormon Christianity. We are blessed to have three people who exemplify that radiance: Jay Griffith, Greta Peterson, and Erica Munson. And I am very pleased to, made a long list of potential candidates for this inaugural session, I must say it was an impressive list of people, and any one of them might be here, but these are people that I know personally, and I have been blessed personally by their radiance. So we'll begin, and I'll have a conversation with Jay, and then I'll have Erica and Greta come up, and we'll continue the conversation, and then we'll give you an opportunity to ask them questions about what we've talked about, and I'll sit down there and let them answer your questions. So let me begin, Jay, by saying, one, that I am very grateful that you've accepted this invitation to be part of this inaugural introduction in Sunstone, of Radiant Mormonism. My guess is that you probably didn't think you were one of the people that I would choose. And yet, in this community, your radiance is evident to lots of people. And so, as before we kind of get to that, I'm kind of interested in you saying a few words about your childhood, about where the seeds of some of the radiance that you exemplify come from in terms of your roots and your early experience.
Well, thank you, Bob. Tell me if you can hear me okay. I talk louder. Are you okay? Okay. I'm not so good at speaking loudly enough. This is kind of an uncomfortable place for me to be in because I just don't see myself as being radiant or that radiant. You know, this is radiance right here. You know, Bob is, yes, thank you. Bob is just this beautiful, radiant soul. So I am I'm just kind of dumbfounded why I would even be here. But I'm grateful to help Bob in any way I can. And I just come from a simple background. My parents are both converts to the church. My mom, when she was 19, my
Speak
dad...
closer to the microphone.
My dad, when he was in his 30s, joined the church after a long search for truth. Exploring Eastern religions, he grew up Catholic in Catholic school, a military school. My mom in a little town in Arizona, in a ranch. And about a year or two after my dad joined the church, he was living in Grants Pass, Oregon, is where he found the church there. Book of Mormon converted him. And he met my mom at picking blueberries for a branch service project. And pursued her, and they married. They would tell you that experience of being members of the church helped them become much better than they would have been without it, particularly my father, who had some challenges growing up in his childhood. My childhood, because of their good souls and their striving to be decent Christian people was very good. I was an only child adopted when I was a baby. My dad became a school teacher, so we never had much money. Moved quite often growing up. My dad seemed to like to get around for some reason. Didn't own homes. We ended up in Brookings, Oregon after my sixth grade year. They got a trailer house and a trailer park, single wide trailer house. Fortunately, Brookings is on the southern Oregon coast overlooking the ocean, so I could actually see the ocean from my bedroom window, so I felt very fortunate. And, you know, I'd never grown up around wealthy people, so a trailer house seemed fine to me. But I had to work a lot and work hard. Money for my mission and money for glasses and clothes and a car and all those things during high school, which I didn't resent and still don't. I value those experiences. But where I raised my family in the East Bench of Salt Lake City, that's kind of a different experience for what my kids grew up with and most people that I know in that area.
If you think back to your childhood, and you think about the metaphor of light. Were there any things that seemed particularly significant as you were growing up that kind of illustrate what we think about in terms of light or radiance?
Yeah. Again, as an only child, I didn't have siblings. I spent a bit of time with adults. I spent a lot of time on my own, the solitude. So I think being alone and in nature, I feel light and illumination. But I have to say also my branch, it's now a ward there in Brookings, Oregon, they were like family to me. And there were people in that sphere that I think nurtured and helped me, which was a blessing. It was particularly a mentor who wasn't a member of our faith. He was a math and physics teacher in high school that I'm still friends with his widow and his sons to this day. He was a light also. He was unabashedly willing to talk about his belief in God in our classroom. In fact, I remember the first day I had him in high school, he brought in a large sunflower. And later on I realized he was describing the Fibonacci code of the seeds and the numbers and how all that worked. And he just described all the complexity of it. And then he just simply said, I just don't think this could happen by accident. And then I and a few others would spend lunch hours with him just because he was so intriguing and supportive. He came to my mission farewell. And again, we remained friends until the day he died. In fact, I was asked to speak at his funeral. So more than just a Mormon radiance, there's a radiance that exists, I think, in connection with God. And particularly, I think, I don't know, it might not be right to say with Christianity, but that's my background. And so that for me is very valuable. And of course I had spiritual experiences within the church growing up. Some that are inexplicable to me, you know. It's hard to understand why God would answer a prayer of a child for something simple like a BB stuck in my ear and my mom and I can't get it out and we're going to have to go to the doctor and I'm afraid to go to the doctor. And so I suggest to her, because that's what she taught me, let's pray. And she's kind of skeptical about doing that. But we kneel down and we pray, and at the end of the prayer, amen, that BB rolls out. And it could be coincident, of course, but for me, it helped me feel like there's a God that loves and cares about me and answers prayers. Of course, as you get older, you hear stories of children praying that are getting abused every day. And those prayers don't seem to be answered. So those are one of the conundrums of life that you try to struggle with in terms of suffering and God.
It seems to me you raise what for many people is a common issue relating to the whole question of light, and that in a world in which we wake up every morning to radiance and to sun talk about the many things. Sometimes it seems, as in what appears to be the capriciousness of deity, or at least whatever deity doesn't seem to conform to what we may wish. There's sometimes a kind of darkness about that which may inhibit the radiance or the sense of radiance or the sense that there is light. So as you grow into maturity and as you've lived your life as a person who has been a student, a person who is a husband, a father, a disciple, all of those things. Have there been irradiant individuals in your life, that is people who you might have turned to for light at times when you had maybe the darkness of doubt or uncertainty? And these could be living people, or they could be people in scriptures or in novels or in your imagination.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, of course, there's been a lot of wonderful people, both dead and alive and historical. You know, it strikes me that we don't have radiance without darkness. So, right? I mean, you wouldn't observe anything radiant without that counter of darkness, which I guess suffering serves a purpose for that, in a sense, and doubt and questioning. You know, this is going to sound trite, but for me, and this just continues to deepen as I get older, you know, Jesus Christ is, for me, that largest light and mentor that I keep turning to. I've spent years reading scriptures and journaling them, and usually it's just dropping into a passage. Sometimes I'll take a topic, but it's often just dropping into a passage and just kind of meditating and thinking on it and just writing all the thoughts and explorations that come to me. And I've spent, you know, over a week or two just on one small passage doing that. And particularly when it comes to, when I've done that with Christ's words, like in the New Testament, thinking about particularly some of his more cryptic things that he says or counterintuitive, trying to understand how that applies in my life and what that might mean. I think that's been fruitful for my development. The autobiography of Gandhi, when I read that, I don't know, 30-some-odd years ago.
Say something about that. What is it about Gandhi that seemed... talk a little bit about the radiance that emanated from this small, little, almost naked Indian man that influenced you a half a world away.
I think it was the courage and strength and integrity of his belief that he was willing to actually go as far as it took to live the ideals that he bought into. I just admired that so much, and it made me really contemplate what those ideals were. It caused me to re-examine our word of wisdom and its counsel to eat meat sparingly, and so I've been mostly vegetarian ever since then. It caused me to be more active in my beliefs and rooted in them more deeply, I think, because I saw, again, in his action, he walked the talk of what he thought was most important. And what he pointed to in what was most important were the things, as he said, that Christ really taught, you know, the most marginalized, the most, those who suffered and needed the most. So, I don't know.
As you've become a father and a husband, can you talk a little bit about the idea of radiance? And I know your wife is a radiant human being.
That she is.
And but could you talk a little bit about the radiance in your own life at home?
Yeah. You know, being married and raising kids is a hell of a lot of work and hard, and you know, it's a challenge.
Sometimes difficult to think about something so esoteric as radiance when you're got to change diapers and wipe noses and do other things, right?
Well, and it's often the challenge of, it's not even those mundane things, it's the challenge of meeting different egos and personalities and trying to all get along, and this idea of free will with children and you know, and you go into these relationships with cultural ideas and expectations of what they're supposed to be and what you think they might be, and you know, most all that gets kind of dashed as people make their own choices, and as you have revealed to you because of your interactions with other people your own weaknesses and faults and shortcomings, but in the midst of all that, again, there's this light and dark thing. In the midst of all those painful and hard things, then you have the opportunity to feel the grace of Christ and of God and see, at least to me, see him, them, her, help you through difficult and challenging times and grow and flourish, and see your kids and your wife do the same, even though their journeys may be very different. In my family, you know, I'm the only one that's engaged in the church, and my children have become atheists, except for my daughter, who's Buddhist, I think. She thinks, sort of. And you know, so just we're all in very different places, but, you know, my love for them continues to grow, and my respect and appreciation for the things they've taught me because of the things that they've done and the choices they've made continues to grow.
And that seems to me to be one of the things that's true about Mormon theology. In this morning's devotion, we talked about grace. And even no matter how dark we are, no matter how much we choose darkness, or no matter how much unintended darkness or shadows may come into our lives, the sun always shines. God's love is always there. And it seems to be one part of the paradox, as you alluded to, that without the darkness, you can't have that. And I've been reading something you recently wrote about running and your legendary running in the mountains and running, starting it when it's very dark and running toward the light, as it were. Can you say something about this as a meditative practice or as something which allows you to move from darkness into light in the natural world, and what kind of influence that might have on you?
Yeah, well, running does become a meditation for me. It's time, I mean, I don't listen to anything, so I'm just in nature on trails, usually. And there's something, in, you know, there's studies about this, psychological studies and physiological studies that, you know, there's endorphins going. There's a lot of things that help when you're out in nature. I mean, nature is its own.
Let there be light.
Yeah, let there be light. Radiance.
And there was light.
So anyway, there's a combination of things that I think going on. This movement of body through a natural sphere. And you've got these chemical things going on in your body, the endorphins. And then for someone who believes in a creation, even though I believe in evolution, that this came about. But there's just all these things compounded in one, and my mind just often becomes very free, and I think childlike in a sense. Some of my most precious moments are where I feel like I'm sort of approaching what Christ says when he says, be as a child, are in those spaces. And everything just falls away, my ego falls away, and I just finished reading, listening to How to Change Your Mind by Michael Pollan. It's all about psychedelic experiences, which my son, oldest son, keeps trying to get me to do with him. And I may. But anyway, they're very similar to what I've experienced in my kind of meditative running states or in nature, where everything is just the sounds and the light and the colors, and all that I see is just so present with me, and I feel so present with it. And I just am, and with God. So there's a lot of things that go into that, and apparently mushrooms can do it for you too. But but I think, you know, part of my background is spiritual experience within the church, and my dad's both openness and yet very conservative nature. Politically and religiously, and yet he was very open-minded. All these things, I mean, we're such an accumulation of millions of years of evolution and our environment and everything, it's hard to say what, you know, what affects us the most. I just feel very grateful for the experience I've had thus far in life, and to... again, I don't understand why I'm here today, how I got involved, and even in Sunstone. I mean, I grew up fairly conservative. I'm not a scholar. I don't have a college degree. So it just...
Jesus didn't either.
Pardon?
So Jesus didn't either.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'm not even close to that.
One of the things that interests me are the this organization you have, Think Again and Faith Again, which has really a broad influence in this community, among a certain group of people, where you bring in lectures and you do things that address those two parts of who we are as human beings. We're blessed with this incredible brain that is the phenomenon of the universe in a way, or at least our brain tells us that it is, but also the heart, which has to do with our faith. And so I'm really interested if you could spend a few minutes talking about your experience in organizing and promoting this idea of bringing people together to talk about issues that concern them and also issues of faith and issues of thought.
Yeah. Well, I'm very curious by nature, and I've always loved to learn and read. I mean, I did spend 3 years at university before I went into business. And, you know, rooted in our theology, and I love what you just said, Joseph Smith taught, that revelation comes to our mind and our heart, right? It's a combination of those two things. And I really just kind of, you know, I guess I feel somewhat led into this thing. Because of a church calling, I met a gentleman who invited me to a group that he and his wife had brought from Boston when she was getting her PhD there, called Think Again. And so I started attending that and enjoyed the intellectual stimulation and the people. And a few years down the road, I suggested we talk about Mormon history and faith crisis. That was 2013 when it was starting to really heat up, that issue. And, you know, my children had left the church by then. And so I tried to get Richard Turley because I had a friend who has been his longtime assistant, and he was working on the church essays back then and was not, he was too preoccupied to be going out and speaking. So I actually thought of a new neighbor and a new home teacher, amazingly enough, to come and speak. And he's actually here today, Jim McConkie and his wife Judy. And Jim filled, I think, better than Richard Turley even would have, the role that evening of talking about that challenging topic. What was interesting is that a typical Think Again, we'd get maybe 10 to 20 people. We had over 80 people come to that topic on that night at Think Again on faith crisis. And so we were being hosted by Mark and Elizabeth England, Eugene England's son, in their home. And Elizabeth said afterwards, maybe we should have a group just to study this kind of stuff once a month. So I tried to pass that off because I was already doing Think Again and had other stuff going on, and I was a little nervous, to be honest with you. I mean, even Sunstone made me nervous, you know, back in that day. So I was, I kind of helped with the first one, and that kind of got off to a rocky start, invited some ward members, and they never came back again, scared them away. We had some core Sunstone people that I think said some scary things for them. So anyway, but the person that I asked to kind of take this over, who was more of a, you know, an actual scholar, unlike me, didn't really want to do it. And so it just kind of fell to me. And so I just started doing it. I guess I was naive enough to think if I asked people like Richard and Claudia Bushman that, I don't know, maybe they'd come, and they did, and the Gibbons, and Adam Miller, and Patrick Mason, and Jana Reese, and, I mean, all these wonderful people that I was curious to learn from and about would come. And then, you know, lesser-known people, too, that would come that were just as impactful and as important. And each month, somehow, you know, the manna would come from heaven, and people would come, and the community has grown. And people, I constantly hear from people how much it means to them to come to a place where they can feel safe to ask hard questions and talk about things that are, you know, uncomfortable and difficult with either family or obviously in church settings and things like that. And, you know, it's been important to the Englands and me and Jane to create a space that that's gentle enough where we're not there to rag on the church. We're there to explore interesting and challenging things at times and to tell our stories, but to not just gripe about everything that we feel like the church isn't doing right. I mean, frankly, the church does a lot right. I find that as an active member who's still engaged, I see a great deal that the church does. I've been serving for a couple of years now in an African refugee branch, and I can't tell you the amazing things that I see members of this church
do. Just a word about that ministry to this inner city branch and how you experience radiance there.
Well, you see, you hear and see a lot of painful stories of people that have, you know, of course, lost everything and seen horrific things, children, and a family that I mentor, a single mom with three kids from three different fathers, who's my daughter's age, 26. her parents were murdered at age 5, and her uncle raised her. You see their courage and strength in what they're doing, but you also see a lot of things as a mentor, and I'm a mentor coordinator there, of problems that I'm not sure how to, they seem intractable. I'm afraid we're going to breed intergenerational poverty, say that word for me. Thank you. Poverty. the church is giving so much. We're paying so many bills constantly. And that's on top of state aid, federal aid, and other organizations out there, the Catholic services and things of that nature. There's so much giving to them. And we're really trying hard to get to them to the point where they're not coming every month and the bishop's having to pay their gas and their rent and their back rent and all these things. So I guess the radiance is in the immense generosity that I'm seeing the church and then individuals who come in give to help of their time and their talents. And people, before I was the ride coordinator, and as I try to arrange rides for these refugees all over the valley to come in to one location and have their meetings together, and the social aspect for them is huge. It's a real challenge, but I'd see these drivers just pick up on their own needs and just fill them on their own. Nobody asking them to, helping them buy a bed or helping them find a new apartment or get a job. I mean, I found it very inspiring, and things that I often didn't think of myself as a driver or as a coordinator. So I think that radiance, it's a simple radiance that I think that sometimes the big luminaries get our attention, but I constantly see radiance in people and simple acts of kindness. One of the most radiant people I know is a gal I used to home teach until she moved this year. Tammy Johnson, when she moved into our ward, this is not just our home ward on the east side, she was addicted to drugs, chain smoker, not a stitch of college education, divorced twice, and she could hardly string sentences together when I first met her. And that ward, and all the bishops until she moved, just took her under her wing. And I suppose she was easy to love because she was very childlike, and she just appreciated so much being in a community. And she'd worked really hard to try to get her young daughters at that time to come and move more on the east side for better schools and better influence, as she saw it. And then to have this ward Jane and I live in a very mixed ward. So we have all kinds of ages, all kinds of incomes. We have, single moms, sometimes on welfare. And then we have people with, multi-million-dollar properties. Doctors and lawyers and school teachers and electricians and plumbers, which is ideal in my mind. But for the most part, they're fairly well educated and definitely better off than most. To see them, just all of them, all these kinds of people, just rally around this woman, help her come into the church, help her with her children, help her as she grieved this last, about a year and a half ago, her one daughter overdosed on heroin, and her other daughter is an alcoholic, and then she had to move, and just going through all these losses and difficulties, and seeing how she held on to her belief in God and Christ, and how many people loved her. I mean, there's so many acts of small radiance that buoyed her and sustained her. And she would tell you that. She would, her testimonies, even before she got baptized, were not articulate, a little awkward, but everyone felt the genuine love.
Seems like a place where a group of people are saying, this little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. In the couple of minutes we have left, if you would be giving advice or counsel or simply suggestions to the leaders of the church about how to make Mormonism more radiant And I know it's really unfair to give you only a couple of minutes to address.
I've given you pages of that.
But if you could think of something that might make Mormonism more radiant in today's world, what would it be?
For the leaders of the church?
For the church, for the institution. Well, you could say it to them. They're the ones who, or you can simply say it to the members. Say it to whatever you think of that might have an influence to improve, expand, magnify the radiance of Mormonism.
Well, I would just say this to all of us. I mean, I think the membership, us in this room, and membership in general, we're the primary responsible holders of where this church goes and where Zion ends up. So as much as I have written and have suggestions and would like the hierarchy of our church to change in things, I think the change will come from us. And I think we're the cause agents right now in a great part of why the church is changing. And so I would just say to all of us and to them, what pops into my mind right now is part of a 12-step, interestingly enough, thing of let go and let grow. And so let's not be concerned so much about so many small details and outward measurements, I guess, of what we think of as success as a church and as individuals. But let's let ourselves grow with the love of Christ and His grace and His teachings and His principles. And focus is really only two commandments. And that's really only one commandment, if you think about it. And that's to love each other. Because you can't love God without loving each other. And that's the only thing we need to attend to.
Thank you so much, Jay.
Thank you.
And Greta, if you and Erica will come up.
Seeing Greta reminded me when I was a student at BYU, the campus was always lit up. And David O. McKay came in his white suits.
Yes. Yeah, we're looking very celestial.
We didn't mean to do that.
Now, I just say it would be appropriate.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Thank you.
For a long time, I've been interested in the physical and metaphysical relationship between light and love. It seems to me on some kind of a cosmic and deep level, those are somehow interconnected, that you can't have light without some aspect of love and you can't have love without some aspect of light. And we have scriptures that are full of those kinds of ideas, that we are the children of light, Christ is the light of the world. So many of those images, light and radiance. And I was very pleased to have both a mother and a daughter who I think in this community exemplify radiance. I think as I read dear Greta's biography, Mark Twain, the first article I published many, many years ago was on an essay, Mark Twain, called The Turning Point of My Life. And I thought as I read Greta's biography that there was a point at which she ran for Senate against Orrin Hatch, and I thought how the world would have been different if Greta had won and how that might have changed so many things. Anyway, I'm just really pleased to have this mother and this daughter who have had such an influence in this community and much beyond this community to here to talk about radiance. And so my first question, I think, is to Erica, who can talk about the same question I ask Jay, the seeds of radiance in your childhood as you were growing up in this home, and how those seeds have somehow grown and manifested in your life.
Sure. Anyway, thank you, Bob, for having us here. Can you hear okay? I had the fascinating experience of when I was 7 years old, we had lived a number of places, but I'd lived in Salt Lake City, East Bench, as home, 7 years old in 1968, to move from Salt Lake City to Cambridge, Massachusetts, which was like time travel, in that Salt Lake was still what I refer to as kind of looking back, of course, but like Eisenhower-era conformity to Cambridge, Massachusetts, which was the hotbed of social change. Everything was up for grabs. And looking to my parents, the way they navigated that has had, I think, is what the important an important aspect in my growing up, in that I went from being in the majority to being the only Mormon at my school, the only, as far as I could tell, person who even went to any church in my third grade class. And so much was, and there were, you know, protests all the time. There were flag burnings and bra burnings, and in Harvard Square, close to my house, on the way home, you know, I'd hear the Hare Krishna devotees chanting, and I'd smell the dope from the hippies, and but I was there was no question, as far as my parents were concerned, that our Mormonism was a really cool thing to bring to this environment.
Say what brought you to Cambridge?
My dad, who had planned to have a career as a in doctor of internal medicine, was asked kind of out of the blue to be the dean of admissions at Harvard College. They were actually looking for someone who could bring more diversity to the Harvard classes. And this, you know, Mormon boy from Utah, although he had Harvard credentials, he'd gone to Harvard College and Harvard Medical School, seemed to be the guy to do that. After, you know, a year or two of getting used to that, I didn't feel like there was anything, that my Mormonism was any weirder than anything anybody else was doing. And also, I think, Mom, I think something Dad brought us is that Dad saw Mormonism everywhere. And in great literature, in civil rights, in everything. And so there wasn't a lot of conflict. And of course, it's a very privileged place to be, in that when you were at that time, if you're the only Mormon in your circle, you get to define Mormonism. So that was a wonderful thing.
So I'll ask Greta the same question. You, going back to your childhood in Utah, and your parents and grandparents and the community you lived in, what were the seeds of radiance for you?
That's such an interesting question, because for me, if you had asked me that when I was 13 or 14, I wouldn't answer it the way I'm going to answer it now, because I didn't see the radiance at that time. I saw the conflict that their feeling about the Mormon Church caused me, because they were very select in the things that they believed in the Mormon Church, and they talked about it all the time. Every Sunday we had all these discussions about, well, you know, the brethren are not always right, and you've got to work through that. You've got to figure out what are they really talking about. Or, you know, you can go to any event, but not on school nights. You can't go to young women because you've got to study. And so education was really a very big thing. And not until I was old enough to announce to my parents. I had a wonderful opportunity to live in Sweden for a year between high school and college. And I was only 18. My aunt Esther Peterson, who, by the way, there's a radiant Mormon. She's amazing because she is a very liberal. She was part of the Kennedy cabinet. She was the one that started the
consumer
movement
for Jimmy Carter.
Yeah, for Jimmy Carter. And she was very, very liberal, and yet she defined herself as a Mormon. People would ask her, well, of course I'm a Mormon. Do you go to church? No. You know, do you live by the standards? Well, I think so. You know, I mean, so it was just a very comfortable thing for her. But anyway, my family had this point of view. And when I called my mother from Sweden, I had thought that I had fallen in love. I was, you know, 6 feet tall. I didn't have boyfriends. And suddenly this Swedish law student was terribly interested in me. So I called and said to my mother, I said, I think that this is the man I'm going to marry. She said, well, you know what we do in our family. You get your degree in college, you get your BA, and then you can decide what you're going to do. So I had no recourse on this one. Thank goodness. It would have been the mistake of a lifetime. But anyway, so I decided, I hustled and said, okay, I'm going to go to BYU. I'm going to go in 3 years, and then John and I will meet again. And so I did go to BYU. I did go through in 3 years. And after the second year, it was clear that this romance had faded. And it was fine on both sides. And so I finished up, and then I got a scholarship to go to Radcliffe in a new program that was taught by the Harvard Business School faculty for
this,
women.
This was before women went to Harvard.
Exactly.
Right? Okay.
And so it was, they had to be in special classes, you know, taught special ways. So and I don't know why that didn't upset me, but it didn't for some reason. But anyway, so here I am in Cambridge, and I'm taking, now, what was your question? I think I've gone too far.
What was the radiance? It was the, what okay. Did you find in that, those experiences?
Okay, well, the radiance was that I was proud of my family. My mother was a great community organizer. She was head of the Board of Education for 25 years or something like that. And my father was also a great veteran, and he would give talks everywhere. And I really was impressed because they were Democrats in Utah County. I mean, that's pretty amazing because it was at that time a little more liberal than it is now. But
Griffith, name your parents.
Okay, George and Al G. Baliff.
Okay.
Yeah, good. So anyway, but they were people that I really respected, except for the conflict on the religious side. And then I'll just quickly tell you that when I went to Radcliffe, I hadn't gone to church at all. And I met Chase at a party. I have a wonderful friend there who kept calling and saying, you've got to go to church. And I said, I just can't do that. And she said, well, would you go on a date? And I said, well, yeah. So I went on a blind date with somebody else, not Chase. But I met him at that party. And he had heard of me because my uncle was teaching at the medical school. And Chase was in his second year of medicine. And I had heard from him because my uncle, Bry, who is not active in the church anymore, said that I should meet him, this nice boy from Utah. And I said, I didn't come back here to meet a nice boy from Utah. I think it's amazing I ever got married, frankly. So anyway, so that was kind of the way it was. But as soon as we met, it was clear that I was very wrong. This is a very interesting man. And he happily felt the same way about me. Now, the reason I'm giving you this background is that when it was clear that we were very serious, I knew that Chase had come from a family very much like ours, except they were a little more conservative. But he was given a lot of latitude, and he was able to. His father was president of Utah State. He was able to just wander that campus. He thought it belonged to him, you know, when he was a little kid. And then he had an opportunity when he was 14 to get a scholarship to a prep school in New England. And after some deliberation, Chase first turned it down because he thought it would be a financial hardship on his father because they were just leaving the presidency at Utah State. But his father came to him and said, Chase, are you sure you don't want to go? And he said, well, as a matter of fact, I do. And so he's my radiance because when it became clear we were going to get married, I said, we've got to have a talk. And you know that I haven't been going to church, and I know how important the church is to you. And it is to me in a way, but these are my questions. And they were very fundamental questions. They really were. And he listened to me, and he said, well, you know, those are important questions. And I hope that you find the answers. And whether or not you do, we're still going to get married. And he gave me this wonderful feeling of expansiveness that I could do what needed to be done. And it was clear to me, though, as we were married for a few years and it was time to have children, that this was clearly important to define myself. And so I did. And we had a wonderful experience with the branches where we were. We were in New Haven. We were in Europe. And always found a comfortable place to worship, and so it helped me. And I am very comfortable in the church, and I am so grateful for it. But I love the definitions that Richard has come up with, the radiance. I think that's terribly important. But Chase has been my radiance, he really has.
And I think it's safe to say you were his. Eric, can you say a word about what your mother just said about the radiance of your father, who was president of the University of Utah, among many other things that he did?
Dad was very comfortable with unanswered questions. But he loved asking them. One, I remember a talk he gave at BYU, which was called "I Don't Know ... and so, because he had a kind of faith that eventually questions would be answered, he was very willing to live within the, you know, I don't know, and made that comfortable for us, too, I think. Another sort of part of, I think, his church experience was the joy in the diversity of experience that you get in a congregation. Now, granted, it wasn't wildly diverse, but he was always just as interested in the experience and the faith and the life of any person in the congregation, and would often come back to tell us, you know, faith-promoting stories about brother so-and-so who would be, you know, who might be assumed by others to be less important, less educated, less whatever, and would get, you know, tears in his eyes to talk about the courage of ordinary people. And that's something that has stayed with me, I think.
Greta, you had an opportunity both in your role as wife and also in your independent role in terms of the things you've done in the community. I'm interested in how you might say something about both of those. That is, you were sometimes in the role of the wife of the president of the university or the dean of students, but you also have been an important figure in the community in your own right. And it seemed to me you've done a beautiful job of blending those two roles. And perhaps you could say something about just that challenge that women face that men don't, of how to blend two different roles to create radiance.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that it was perhaps easier for me than some because our kids were grown and they were away at college and they came during holidays, and Erica had her first two children at that time. Is that right?
You're talking about when Dad was president
when
of the
When Chase was president of the U, yeah. So it was a good time for us, and I ended up doing things that I didn't expect to do. An example of one is that I was called to be a juror in a case that was a child sexual abuse case. And I had never been exposed to that issue ever. And I was sure they wouldn't pick me because I had been a public person and I thought, well, you know, they probably wouldn't want that. Well, they did pick me. So there I was. I was stuck. And I was very upset about the trial because it was two little boys. The father had been accused of sexually abusing them when they were very, very young. And it was a terrible case, and the amount of discussion about the processes and how the children were handled, it turned out that those kids had been in waiting for a court date for 2 years. Mm. And they were also handled very awkwardly. They were interviewed by a policeman at the police station. And this happened every 2 or 3 months. So they must have had these endless questions. And by the time they got into court, they were terrified. And of course, they made mistakes in terms of what they said. And it was a very good defense attorney that was always cross-examining them. So I felt terrible about it. And by the time we had to go in and make a decision, we couldn't get anybody to move on anything. And so I just decided, well, we have to have some resolution here. So I'm going to cave in, and we'll go in, and it will be the result of the case. The children will be found guilty. The father had a lot of support from other places.
The kids were found guilty?
I mean, the kids were found...
The father was not found guilty.
The father was not found guilty.
Okay, the father was acquitted.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. That's why it's so nice, Aunt Charles. But anyway, to make a long story short... I was so upset about that, I couldn't think about anything else. And so I made a decision that every week I would see two people that were involved in that case. And there were just all kinds of people. It had been going on for so long. Guardian ad litem, the children's services, all kinds of things, medical, psychological interviews and so forth. So... I decided that I'm just going to talk to two people a week, and I started with the judge, and I told him how upset I was, and he said, well, I was upset too, but we do the best we can with what we've got, and we don't have money to put into this. We need changes, but there's just no way we can do that with the budgets that we have. So I thought, this is not good news. But anyway, I started talking, and 6 months later, I had talked to everybody that was involved in that case, and I was committed to doing something, and so I called the governor because I knew him, and I went over and talked to him and told him, and he said, look, we've been wanting to improve the quality of those cases for a long time. So he got me involved, and I ended up heading a task force on this, and it lasted 6 years. And we met every month. And you can easily lose sight of what you're doing in that period of time. But these people were amazing, and everybody was committed to improving the situation. And we had people that could write the legislation, and we talked to the legislature and everybody that we needed to talk to. And so we finally got the legislation through, and we got, as a result of some traveling that I did purposely for this, we had a whole new program. It's called the Children's Justice Centers. Right. Maybe you've heard of them. And these are places where the children are brought. It's a very warm home feeling. And they are interviewed by people who are specialists in interviewing children. And they have a weekly multidisciplinary team that decides whether or not it's court-worthy. And what it does, it focuses more on the children and the families. And, I mean, it's an amazing thing.
And this seems to me, Greta, an example, and I'm so delightful to hear this story, because the radiance of that will be here for many years. It's like a star. We see the radiance of stars coming, of stars that actually extinguished millions of years ago, if not billions, but their light is still coming. And the light of that determination of you to get at the truth, to look at this, and to then do something about it is really a wonderful example. I think that's what Richard was talking about, that Mormons take charge. Mormons can do something more. There's something in our religion that says to us we can change the world, and that is a beautiful example.
Well, I didn't think about that.
I know you didn't.
No,
I know you didn't.
No,
but that's how you are built. That's how you grew up.
That's true.
That's what
my mother did. That
yeah. No, and Mormonism has a lot to do with
that.
Yeah,
that's true.
And I want to say, ask how that example transfers to Mormon building bridges, which you have done such a beautiful job.
Let me say one
of.
Thing first.
Mm-hmm, sure, absolutely.
We started the first one in 1987, and there are now 25. Every county
in Utah
has a Children's Justice Center.
What a wonderful thing.
So, okay.
So, the segue to from that beautiful example to another beautiful thing is Mormons building bridges.
But you didn't know about that. You didn't know about what I was doing, did you?
Yeah, I did.
Oh.
Sure did. Okay, so, and I apologize for anybody who's heard the Mormons building bridges origin story before, but So what happened is that I met my husband in Cambridge, and we've raised five kids and lived in Europe for a while and lived all over. Never lived in Utah. Came back always to see grandma and grandpa, but hadn't lived in Utah. In 2009, we moved back to Utah. Different things came together for us to do that. And it was the shock of being in a ward where there is this Mormon, and being in a community where's the Mormon, non-Mormon thing, and the us and them feeling. So my ward is in Sandy. Sandy is about a 50-50 area in terms of Mormon, non-Mormon. I'd never felt that before. I'd heard about it, but I hadn't experienced it. And it was so funny, like when we were moving into our house in Sandy, to have, you know, neighbors come to the door and you do the little dance to see who's Mormon and who's not. And when the non-Mormons would figure out that we're Mormon, you saw the light go out of their eyes. I mean, they are lovely people, but it was kind of like, oh, they're not on our team. And I just felt awful about that and had grown up in a community that where there was lots of different kinds of people and living in that juxtaposition was just really enriching for me, and I wanted to, and I just felt like, come on, there's got to be something I can do. So I love sort of defying conventional knowledge that if you are this, you have to be that. And because here I was, you know, I was Mormon girl from Cambridge. I was also, I ended up going to Harvard for my undergrad. Speaking of, I called mom as an undergraduate and told her I was getting married, and she didn't say no. And so I got married as an undergraduate at Harvard, which is like wacky. No, but like no one got married in 1980 in Cambridge. People were like, tell us about this marriage thing. Anyway, so I loved that kind of, you know, I can define who I am kind of thing. And I was a stay-at-home mom for 20 years, with the Harvard degree. And so got here and then just felt like, okay, how can I, what's something symbolic that would shatter people's conventions about, this is what the Mormon community does, and this is what the non-Mormons do. What could I do? Where do Mormons not hang out? Pride festivals. Probably not. A lot of ex-Mormons, but not a lot of Mormons. I had never been to a Pride Festival. And so, just as a one-time thing, I booked a space in Utah Pride in January, forgot about it. Then it's May, and I got to do something, and sent out some emails to friends. And I think this is where the radiant Mormonism comes in. As I said, let's march in our Sunday clothes with affirming scriptures, not against the church. Let's march because of our religion. And, you know, hoped 25 people would show up and 350 people showed up. And it was in the air. So many other people were thinking about this, I think. I think that maybe the pain of Prop 8 was, I won't say healed, but Mormons who'd been good soldiers for Prop 8 but felt really bad about it were ready to try to do something, ready to say, I really would like to show some love and acceptance. So anyway, so it became clear that there was way more that had to be done. And so I was shocked that my bishop in Sandy was completely supportive of what I was doing the week before the first march. I just went in and said, just want you to know, this is what I'm doing. This is our mission statement. And he was very supportive. And it's just been a wonderful, wonderful learning experience. We are a grassroots community, you know.
How many years now are you?
We're now, so 2012, 6 years. And we, as you know, as some of you may know, we're now trying to make inroads into more conservative parades than pride parades.
Can any good come out of Provo? Wonderful editorial.
It did. And we were able to have a really interesting experience this spring with Provo citizens, city council, county council, and we sponsored a LGBTQ veterans float in Provo, and it was a beautiful experience. We're still waiting for Days of 47 to come around. What's really interesting is talk about like that for my dad, that unanswered question. We want to help people manage this dissonance. Okay? We want to work within the existing context of the church, not necessarily in a, just that this is a fact. This is what the church is right now. Okay? How do we deal with that? And we totally understand our mission statement is making LDS homes, congregations, and communities safe and welcoming for LGBTQ people. So, and supporting those people on their life's path. So we completely understand that staying within the church is not for everybody, but my impulse was I didn't want to be spending time in the vineyard if I wasn't trying to welcome everybody else in. And so it's a really interesting practice of walking a line and trying to, and we don't ask for approval from the church, but we want this organization to be a place where people, where True Blue Mormons can show love and support if that's what they want to do. We're also, you know, plenty of progressive Sunstone types, but we want to be that space for Mormons who are good. Because if we ask, if you ask a certain kind of Mormon, okay, you're either going to have to, you know, stick with the orthodoxy or support your gay brothers and sisters, they're going to stick with the orthodoxy. So we're trying to show ways that both of those things can happen at the same time, which is tricky.
And I think the wonderful thing about Mormon building bridges in that metaphor is it is a metaphor of building bridges between non-Mormons and Mormons, between liberals and conservatives. But also it's a bridge, I think, from darkness and ignorance to light and knowledge. Mm-hmm. And that metaphor, it seems to me, is wonderfully exemplified in the work that you and your colleagues have done. This question, yeah, let's do that. This is a question for Greta. Greta, you have, in your position and through the power of your personality, you've been privileged to associate with maybe six or seven or more presence of the church, as well as a number of apostles and prophets, as well as leaders in the community, non-Mormons. Can you, out of that panoply of radiant people, identify maybe just one of them who to you exemplifies radiance?
Well, the category would be church leadership, maybe.
It could be anyone. Just radiant people.
Well, within the church, I was surprised, not really, but didn't expect to have an opportunity to get to know President Uchtdorf. And he reached out to us in that we had never met them before, or he, and we had some mutual friends that were encouraging us to go and call and make a call on him so we could get to know them. But we weren't comfortable doing that, so we just kind of forgot it. And then
that's you and Chase.
Yeah. So we didn't. And then he made an effort to see us, so he responded and asked us to lunch. And so we did go to lunch. And I was extremely impressed with his openness, with his ability to talk about issues, even though perhaps they didn't agree with all of the solutions that had been put out there in the marketplace. I don't remember exactly what the substance was, but I was impressed with him. And I told Erica there was one thing, well, I can talk about this. There was one thing that worried me a little bit.
When he was talking about Berlin?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is that okay?
I think you talked about that.
Anyway, I told him about Erica and Mormons Building Bridges, and he said, "Oh yes, we know of that." And and he said, "You know, it's one thing to walk in a gay pride parade in Salt Lake City, and it's another to walk in the gay pride parade in Berlin." He's absolutely right about that, because Germany was where Berlin was the place where so many of the gay and transvestite population were, and maybe they were public for the first time, maybe.
I think Berlin has a fabulous history of gay and transgender, particularly during Weimar Republic.
Yeah.
and a lot of, but I think the Utah Pride Parade is the most family-friendly Pride Parade
in the
country.
World.
Yeah, in the world. And I'm sure he's seen images from Berlin that were shocking to
him.
Yes, so,
I'm sure.
You know.
Yeah. But he was extremely kind, and as we were leaving, he said, "Tell Erica to be careful." that's so typical. And that, for me to remember that, you know, that's typical of me, because I was kind of worried, too. And I had said to Erica before, you know, "Are you going to get excommunicated?" And you made it very clear to me. And as I got to know more about the work that you were doing, Erica's not having, doesn't have, they don't have anything to do with doctrine. They're not changing doctrine. They're changing individual lives, supporting lives of people. And that's a very big difference. And so.
I'm just going to be the rabble-rouser here. That's fine. If anybody wants to excommunicate me, fine. We have beautiful examples of excommunicated Mormons who have continued to have a beautiful life in the church.
I know, and so I'm just a worried mother.
I know. That's wonderful.
Well, you reacted.
But not anymore.
You reacted like I did, Erica, when my state president went to the inauguration of President Gardner at the University of Utah. He came back, and at that he met Harold B. Lee. And my state president came back and said, I was talking to Harold B. Lee, and he said, "Oh, Los Angeles, isn't that where Bob Reese is?" And I thought, they know my name.
Yeah.
Help. And what was really interesting is that President Lee said, "Tell Bob Reese," I was editor of Dialogue at the time, "tell Bob Reese that he could use his talents with BYU Studies."
Bob, I wanted to say, though, that the real radiance that I remember and think about are Richard and Claudia Bushman.
Yes.
They live what they talk. They walk their talk. And they are absolutely amazing, because when we were a group of women in Cambridge worried about the women's movement, meeting once a week and complaining, It was Claudia who said, we've got to do something. We've got to write. Well, I didn't want to write. You know, it was more fun to sit there and complain. But she absolutely focused that group, and we started writing. And as a result, Exponent 2 came to life, and so many wonderful things. And I noticed they still have a blog, and they're doing some good stuff. So she's just absolutely one of them.
They do. And it was one of my privileges as editor of Dialogue to publish the famous pink issue that came out of this wonderful group of women who started Exponent 2. There's so many things we could spend more time on. Our time is almost gone, and since you've invoked Richards and Claudia, let me close by just saying a few words about what Richard said. He said, Mormonism in some way downplays the role of the church with its mission of salvation. He says, I think just the awesome people saying, well, what does Radiance have to do with the church? And he says, I think it has a lot to do with the church. It magnifies the essential mission of the church. The church is the sun where the rays originate. It is the core where nuclear fission generates energy and light and sends it beaming out into space. Nothing works if the church does not perform its vital function. Generation after generation, it has to produce people of goodwill. What is the power that creates that kind of goodwill? What is the nuclear fusion at the core of the sun? It's the same in Mormonism. I'm searching for the words. Is it testimony or faith? The scriptures speak of the precious fruit desirable above all others, all other fruits. The Savior called it the pearl of great price. I think of it as a salvation. I think the only thing that would motivate so much selflessness is the promise of becoming what we want to be in our highest aspiration. It is the hope that God will lift us up. He will make us holy, loving, and intelligent. He will make us worthy to be loved and accepted. That promise moves us to consecrate our lives. And so the church, and I love his imperatives, and so the church must perform its mission of salvation. And so Radiant Mormonism must extend Mormon influence. We must tend to the core where the energy comes from, and we must welcome the radiation of Mormon influence across the face of the earth. Every day we add to the sum of goodwill among humankind. Someday that goodness may save the world, and the goodness that radiates from these three radiant Latter-day Saints we've had today certainly gives us hope that it will. Thank you so much.
Thank you.